Welcome to In The Mood For Podcast with Callum Reid of UltimateAddict.com and Pete Shepherd of InTheMoodForBlog.blog.co.uk.
Bravo.
This is Spidey special.
It is a Spidey special. It's the first time we delayed recording the podcast.
For a film, specifically.
For a film, yeah. So what we're going to do next week, I've no idea.
But we'll see if the film was worth it.
We will.
We're also going to do top fives of the year so far, with it being the first week of July.
Yes, there's a half-yearly awards, or assorted mentions.
Yeah, yeah, those that are worth it.
Yeah, well, with some padding.
And we're going to review some theatrical releases from this past week.
And some others that are still kicking around the art houses. Yes. Here, so we're going to dive straight in then with the amazing Spider-Man to give it its full title,
which we've just seen like literally minutes.
Yep. I sacrificed the quarterfinals of Wimbledon for this.
The last game.
Yes.
Is it the amazing Spider-Man?
Well, I saw a tweet from Tim Robey, who's writer for the Telegraph, and he was retweeting someone else who called it the adequate Spider-Man. And I don't think I'd go down that far, but it's certainly closer to adequate than amazing for me.
I think adequate is more in the context of that it's a remake from a film that happened 10 years ago.
Yeah, reboot. My God, I hate that word.
Reboot. I hate it. Let's just call it a remake, because it is the origin story again.
Yes.
Except with Andrew Garfield as Spider-Man, rather than Tobey Maguire.
Yeah. And I think a lot of this, for most people, because most people who are seeing this will have seen the Tobey Maguire Spider-Mans. Or at least one of them.
Yeah.
One of the three. You can't get away from the baggage. It's like an adaptation. It's like we were talking last week about Joe Wright's Anna Karenina. There are lots of adaptations of Anna Karenina, and most people would have seen, well, probably one. And so with this, I think you can't get away from it, but then again, you've got to judge it on its own merits.
Was he better than Tobey Maguire?
Yes, but I didn't like Tobey Maguire. But also, I think Garfield was probably the weakest link in this, really, for me. I think he's an actor in general who has a very good shtick. His shtick being the bumbling, mumbling, sort of like half-charming Jimmy Stewart modern type guy.
Yeah.
He's fine when he does that, but when he gets pushed to actually emote something, I usually find him quite ridiculous. And certainly on not necessarily at the end of this one, but in the potted bits when he has to actually deliver something dramatically, I was laughing, especially with the what happens with his uncle.
I think it works better in a film like this than it would in a more serious film, because it felt like part of it felt like an audition for like a cocaine addict or something.
Yeah, there's some weird frenzied like little bits to him.
Yeah,
and then when he reverts back to the sort of usual Andrew Garfieldness, he's fine. But then there's also what am I thinking of? There's also bits where he's smiling like way too much, and it's almost as if he's been told to smile, It just doesn't really fit with like the particular scenes or what have you. And they're obviously going for a certain tone to the whole piece, which I think in general holds up quite well. And I think that's why I wasn't the biggest fan of the Tobey Maguire Spider-Mans, because it was very, very jokey / comic-y /
it was true to the material.
Yes.
Or at least it felt true. I don't know if
yes.
Fanboys would agree with that.
Yes, well, this is the thing. I mean, I'm British. For British people, comic books means the Beano and the Dandy, or people of my age anyway. it's not the same thing.
It's not the same geek culture.
No, it's very different. I mean, there are, don't get me wrong, there are those kind of comic book fans, but it's not got the same stigma. It's not got the same. It's not a cult. It's different culture, completely different culture. So yeah, I'll run down the plot for anyone who doesn't know the plot of what they're going on. This one is Peter Parker becoming Spider-Man, and in this particular one, the baddie is Reese Iffens, who is a former friend of his father's. His father's died, because that's what happens in every single Marvel backstory. And he's interested in cross species breeding. Well, it's not breeding. Cross species. What's the
regeneration?
Yes, that sort of thing. Cloning, sort of cloning.
Stem cells, yeah. Kind of thing.
It's all very wishy washy. So Peter Parker becomes Spider-Man. Reese Iffens becomes something else, and it all throbs towards the inevitable showdown.
It takes quite a while to get going, like in terms of telling his story before he becomes Spider-Man.
Yeah,
it felt like a lot longer than it did in the Raimi film.
Yeah, well, it takes about a couple of reels, 20 minutes, 25 minutes to have him be bitten, and then it probably takes, I'd guess, about the same amount of time for him to get the suit on. Yeah. So you're looking at a good 45 minutes to an hour before he's even got the suit on.
I think it's an hour.
Yeah, it probably
is. Like an hour.
It probably is. Oh, it might be 45 minutes before the Uncle Ben thing happens, which, if you've seen Spider-Man, then yeah.
I'm surprised they went there again.
Yeah.
I think because I haven't seen the Sam Raimi films for a while, that I have an elevated opinion of them, because I did like them quite a lot to begin with.
Yeah.
But this one brought out the flaws of those films for me, in that it has a preoccupation with guilt.
Yes, responsibility.
In shaping his character, that comes off as really heavy-handed.
Well, I think with this one in particular, I think you're talking about the characterization. I think the character motivation is really spotty throughout this film, and that's probably what, I don't think it makes it a bad film. I don't think this is a bad film at all.
No.
But I think that's what prevents it from being a really good one, is that the basic character motivation for Peter Parker to become Spider-Man is revenge, because his uncle gets shot, and then he's got to he chases down a load of different villains who will fit the basic description of whoever the killer was. This is completely jettisoned at a certain point in the film, and then never mentioned ever again. And and around that same time, you were talking about the Avengers. We talked about the Avengers the other week, and you said that there wasn't really a reason for Loki in the Avengers to ever be in his bonnet. There's no reason at all for Reese Iffens to ever be in his bonnet in this film. I
kind of disagree. I think this was better than Loki, because the way that it happens and the sort of hang up he's got about is he's got like an amputated arm, hasn't he?
Mm-hmm. Nicely blue screened, green screened. Not too atrocious on that front.
Yeah, it's not bad. But I think that the way that they do it, in terms of him becoming somebody who wants to kind of correct the flaws of others, I think it works better than Loki's does anyway.
Yeah, I think a lot of it was sort of tacked on after the fact. It's like he's already doing it, and then you go and see a video, and it's like about 30-second rambling speeches, and you just think, okay. So why are you on a bridge again? Why destroying cars? So and then it sort of like shifts long, and so into something else. And I mean, on the one hand, okay, yeah. I'm not gonna diss Chris Nolan. I promise. First, I'm not going to. I'm not going to use the line. If it, not everything is going to be like a Chris Nolan superhero film, where you've got like massive arc cross-cutting between two storylines over a half-hour period or what have you. Not every film's going to be like that, and not every film is going to push every single character motivation, flesh every single character motivation out. But so in that respect, I find it would be quite interesting in about a year or two's time to actually watch this and The Dark Knight Rises back to back and see the differences in approach.
Yeah,
but
I think the thing that makes Ifans as a villain a bit more tolerable is that he isn't really the villain.
Yeah, can I just ask a question? When did it become acceptable or the done thing in Hollywood for Reese Ifans to play professors or really, really hyper intelligent people? I mean,
it's a far cry from Notting Hill, isn't it?
Did I miss the memo on this one?
He's definitely improving. But I liked him in Anonymous.
I'm not questioning the acting chops. I'm just when I think Reese Ifans, I don't think Professor.
This in 5-year engagement, yeah.
Yes, it's the second film in a month where I'm supposed to be taking him seriously as an intellectual.
We haven't mentioned Emma Stone.
No.
Yet. Love interest for Andrew Garfield,
who is apparently the Sunderland's favourite actress under the age of 30, or maybe the whole Tyne and Wear region. Who knows?
Was she not like second or third? I think I put third.
Well, I can't remember where she was. Oh god, yeah, it was Paquin, wasn't it? Yeah.
But yeah, she's maintained herself well. She's fine.
Especially, she was decent for most part, and then at the end, she has a big scene at the end. She does very well with it. I think for me, and this isn't going to be a surprise. It'll be less of a surprise coming from you because you like Brothers and Sisters. But I thought Sally Field was a standout on the acting front in this one.
Well, Sally Field was kind of doing in Brothers and Sisters, but
really,
sort of, yeah.
But Brothers and Sisters light,
but less good. Yeah. But just kind of maternal. She's got that whole, she can turn from kind of concern to sort of make you feel at home very easily.
Yeah.
That was like the main source of the laughs in the audience for me, was them two, her and Martin Sheen.
Oh, right. The biggest laughs we got were inappropriate moments, I think. Remember when he throws a spidey thing and then spins a stone towards him and kisses her?
Yeah.
That got a massive laugh in Birmingham. this is probably the biggest time when the tone really isn't handled by Mark Webb?
Yes. 500 appropriately, days appropriately named Mark Webb.
Nicely done, sir. The subway scene when the woman's top gets taken off. That was so it was more. So it was more the women laughing at the silliness. But it wasn't very overall. I think the tone's handled quite well.
I think Mark. Mark Webb, director of 500 Days of Summer,
and numerous music videos. Not that you could tell from this film at all,
There is one moment that is completely his. I thought it was great.
which one for you?
Where they're fighting in the school. Spider-Man and the
Stanley cameo. The Stanley cameo. Because the bloke at the front, he's in every single Marvel film because he created them. And rather memorable scene in Morrats, because obviously Kevin Smith loves his comic books and he got Stanley to actually appear as Stanley in there and give a nicer couple of speeches. But
you're talking about the guy in the headphones, yeah?
Yes, that's Stanley, yeah.
Yeah. But that I thought that was really funny.
Yes, that was the you can tell it's the shifting it out, and you can tell this guy's done music videos. You could tell even if you already didn't know.
Yeah.
Or watching this,
I think there are a couple of dodgy cuts here and there, I think.
Mm.
But it's not a bad action film.
Let's talk about it in terms of an action film then. What do you think of the set pieces, the visual effects? About par, above average?
Probably worse.
Really?
Worse than Raimi's. I think Raimi shot it in such a way that it felt a lot more important.
Mm.
The swinging through the air. I think it just looked a lot more lush.
Yeah, the thing. I suppose you've got to try and make it your own, and so there's a POV cam. So it's like you see like Spider-Man's. It's like you are seeing what Spider-Man sees as he's swinging. They use that quite a few times. I thought that was effective, but it's not the wow factor of.
It's more Nolan, really, to name drop Nolan again, but it's more kind of modernizing it a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I agree with you in general. I think the special effects were better in the Raimi ones. I mean, even in the films that didn't get as good a reception, in 3, I mean, the special effects of with the sand is just was at the time wowsville. But then again, I mean, when you see these films, they look amazing in there, and then you see them like 5 years later on TV, and you think, my God, that looks awful.
Yeah,
I've had that with. A little bit on King Kong, not much, but a little bit on King Kong, and some of the Lord of the Rings backdrops look shoddy as hell now.
Yeah, some of them do.
But
when Gandalf falls to his
yeah, and some
in the first one,
yeah, and some of the the backdrops in the elf, what's it? I can't remember what the elf kingdom's called, but like when you like see out the window. No, the elves. Is it probably something door? Anyway, digression. Yeah.
Anyway.
So, what do you think of Garfield?
I think he's got a lot of charm, which is what.
Did you buy him as a high school student? Can you tell from my point of view from the way I phrased that question?
I can tell, and I agree.
Why not just do it in college?
He's got a kind of been there, done that kind of.
Wouldn't it be because they want to get away from the Raimi Maguire ones? Why not? And they're having that's all about MJ. So and they're going with Gwen Stacy in this. Why not just set it in college? I mean, it's not that big a stretch.
And, yeah, it really isn't. And the whole bully.
It's so trite and overdone.
I think because they didn't make it a lot more adult in terms of their relationship.
Well, yeah, because they want it. Yeah.
Than the other film, like Gwen is a much more interesting character, but maybe
with
that's
much more
just
interesting
Emma Stone.
Mini skirts. She did dress.
And bare legs was
knee highs. She did dress like a Japanese porn star, for the most part. So overall, I think it's fine for what it's trying to do. I don't think it's spectacular.
It's coming after, not after something that's amazing, but it's coming at such a short time, and it hasn't really broken the mold.
It's like the Incredible Hulk reboot.
Yeah.
It's probably about the same level for different reasons with different bits to appeal within it. And can I just say that there is absolutely no way on earth that there should have been a Coldplay song in this, and that's what you get when you hire the director of 500 Days of Summer to do your summer blockbuster. You will get a Coldplay song because he's a hipster.
When was the Coldplay song?
About a couple of wheels in when you're doing his first training. He's doing his first like training on to sort out his newfound Spidey powers. I'm 100% sure there was a Coldplay song in there.
I caught a Rear Window poster, so that was good.
Oh God, yes. Okay. Right. Shall we?
Yeah.
Shall we? Have we done there? Yeah.
I'm done. Yeah. Are you?
Yeah, I haven't got anything else to infuse or slate.
Probably not worth the huge.
It wasn't worth the delay. Let's put it that way. But it was probably more entertaining than watching Victoria Azarenka shriek like she's had a red poker inserted into somewhere. Okay, so also out last Friday is Friends with Kids, which stars half of the cast of Bridesmaids.
Yeah, or probably more than half the cast.
But none of whom were in the two leads. Do you want to do the basic setup, or shall I?
Yeah, you can do it.
Okay, the basic setup is that there's a set of friends, which is half of the cast of Bridesmaids, and then who are married to each other. So you've got John Hamm's married to Kristen Wiig, Chris O'Dowd's married to Maya Rudolph, and the other two who aren't together but they've been friends forever are Adam Scott and Jennifer Westfeldt. Jennifer Westfeldt, who wrote and directed the film.
Bravo.
Nicely done. So what happens is these two, they've got no interest in each other whatsoever, sexually or in terms of being attracted to each other, but they see how awful their married friends have it, how the kids ruin the relationships, and how they're not happy, and so they decide to cut that out, decide to have the benefits of having kids without how it ruins your relationship.
Yeah.
So they plan to have the baby and not get romantically involved. And you can probably guess where that's going to go if this was going to be a normal romantic comedy, but for the most part, it really sets its stall out like it's not going there, which I liked.
Is it?
Yeah. Well, I thought it did. And then it, you slowly but surely, and probably more quickly, you realise that they actually are going exactly where.
I don't think it matters that they're going there, though. I think that's the point.
Mm.
It's about the journey more than the aim.
Yeah, I think the thing is it's a very snarky relationship that these two have. They're like college friends who've known each other forever.
And yeah, it's strange.
It's really quite funny. I mean, there's some really good one-liners, and I think
when she's going on about her boyfriend's. A well-endowed boyfriend.
This is the thing, because in some this is why you can tell it's written by a woman, because in some films, and I think a good random example is something like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, the worst thing that Charlie Kaufman has Kate Winslet say about Jim Carrey is that he's boring, and then the worst thing that he has Jim Carrey say about Kate Winslet is that her sex isn't motivated. So there's an inherent imbalance between those two things. The one is far more meaner than the other, but with this they kind of get it nailed on. Each gets it just as badly as the other, so the guy doesn't compare very favourably to Ed Burns in the trouser department, and then Adam Scott's always going on about how flexible his new girlfriend is with her extremely well large chest. So I do think it balances out, and it's refreshing that it balances out, because sometimes it doesn't, and that always leaves kind of questionable little undertones that sort of gnaw away at people like me, at the very least. So I did like that. I do think they get it, that they kind of both sides get it quite equally. I just wish they followed through with it in the way that, because if I was kind of, I was thinking, oh wow, they're really setting it up like this, and it reminded me of He's Just Not That Into You. The Ben Affleck Jennifer Aniston subplot in that, where it's all the whole way through, he's saying, I'm never gonna get married, don't believe in it. So they break up, and you think, okay, they break up, and then they get back together, and she realizes that it actually doesn't matter if they get married or not, because I was thinking, bravo, great, you've got all these potted different storylines, all the others are being tied up nicely. Here's a really refreshing way to actually say, you know what, marriage isn't the be all and end all. And then of course Affleck completely capitulates. And it was kind of like that with this. It's really nice that okay, fine, you've actually got these two people who are friends, they've been friends forever, and they're not attracted to each other. And
do you not feel like it was a bit of a one day situation? Except not obviously not as romantic, but in terms of their friendship
over the years?
Because it did last a few years, didn't it? Three or four years.
There is no romance whatsoever, and that's by the end, I mean like the last couple of scenes, I was laughing at that, and that was the one point in the film, it got to that point that I was laughing at it rather than with it.
But that's always the hardest bit.
Exactly.
Really.
Yeah.
It annoyed me at the beginning because I didn't like how they portrayed
the married people.
Yeah. And some of the jokes were really crass and obvious. And I just thought that was like, it just rubbed me up the wrong way. But it gets to about half an hour, and then it's the relationship between Westfeld and Scott just feels really natural and funny.
Yeah.
I like the two of them together.
Although what I don't understand is if they've got these two people and they're going to have a baby together and they don't allegedly don't have any feelings for each other, and then they actually come to conceive the child, why they then would start having a missionary kiss fest as the way that they're going to actually have sex. I was thinking, there are more just simple get in there, get the job done method ways that you could have gone about it. It is a very cynical relationship in general, and the cynical characters. I think what exacerbates that for me is Scott's got this very
playboy.
Not persona. He's got a very cold aura about him. He's quite aloof. And that's just him as an actor. I don't necessarily think it's some deep character work. And so, I think that kind of doubly stops any sort of romance kicking in. And it's fair enough. And I actually quite like the way he was just sticking to his guns for like 80% of the film.
Yeah.
And just being, but he wasn't really being misogynistic. He was just very clear about what he wanted.
Yeah. Which is rare in a man.
Yeah, he got his dream girl, dropped everything, thought, right, this is my dream. His dream girl is Megan Fox, and why not? It just proves that he's got the dreams of a 15-year-old boy.
Can we talk about Megan Fox? Because she's fairly good in this.
Yeah, she's fine. She's fine, and not without talent. Not without talent.
I think she gets a bad rap because of the roles that she chooses,
and also the way that she publicly had a spat with Michael Bay. But then again, who doesn't publicly have a spat with Michael Bay?
More people should have a spat with Michael Bay.
Exactly. He doesn't come across as the nicest guy in the world, so call him out on it.
Yeah.
I don't have a problem with it. There's nothing. I mean, there are actresses out there who've done far worse with more than she does in this film. I mean, she doesn't do anything doesn't do anything wrong with it at all, doesn't let the side down, and you've got some very talented people in there, so if you're not letting the side down, that's fine. Westfeld, for me, the reason I like Ryan Reynolds is because I used to watch Two Guys, a Girl, and the Pizza Place, and she was in the first series of Two Guys, a Girl, and the Pizza Place, and it depressed me how much work she's had done to her face.
I think in the last third
especially, but yeah, I think for a while it tried to do a few different things within the constraints of the genre, but then the genre does win the battle, and they do end up going in the directions. So I think it's in the end it's a bit of a mishmash, and it's a comedy, and it's got a lot of laughs. So I always think it's going to be decent on those stakes, but I don't think it's fully successful in what it's trying to do.
No. It's got a winning cast, and because she's directed it, it feels like it's kind of been conceived more together, which I like the idea of that. But I agree. I think it's a bit of a mixed bag. I enjoyed it by the end, but, you know.
I was the other way around. I enjoyed it until the end. But that's actually a very nice segue, because speaking of films that were... feel like they're conceived by the cast, because apparently Your Sister's Sister, which was also out on Friday, that's actually how it came about. It's a lot of improvisation, and it actually gets they all the cast get like a creative credit as the credits were rolling. I was walking out, and I was thinking, what's that? And then yeah, it turns out afterwards it was a bit of the Michael Ease with this.
That's
one.
That's cute.
So I'm gonna rattle through this. Your Sister's Sister is a film starring Emily Blunt, because apparently we can't go a week on this podcast without talking about two things. One is French films, and then the other is films with Emily Blunt in them. There are three out at the moment. You can go and see three different Emily Blunt films.
What's the other one?
Salmon Fishing is still doing the rounds.
Is it?
It's still, and it's for the next couple of weeks, it's still doing the rounds at independent cinemas around where I am. So Your Sister's Sister, which stars Mark Duplass of the Duplass brothers and their non-fame.
Pumped in. They're
in directors. Indie directors. So he is the lead. He is a bloke who whose brother has died a year before. Emily Blunt is said brother's ex-girlfriend and his best friend. And she suggests to him that he's a drunken mess and that he should go to her father's cabin to sort himself out, have some me time for a week while on his own. And so he does so, and when he goes up there... So when he goes up there, he gets to said cabin, and Emily Blunt's half sister Rosemary DeWitt is already in the cabin. Before too long, it turns out she's a lesbian, but that doesn't stop her from having sex with a Mr. Duplass after a drunken night.
No.
So then the next day, after the turning of the lesbian. Emily Blunt, even though she said she's going to be away for a week, turns up in the car and is a surprised to see a sister who's just got out of a 7-year relationship with the woman that she was with, and shenanigans don't ensue, but the drama takes over from there. So as you can hear from your groaning,
this sounds awful.
it's a very trite setup with some, but the explanations for the triteness do come, and they're fine. This is 100% reliant on the cast, because there's and apparently it must come from, it doesn't surprise me that it's been there's been improvisation, because a lot of stuff is skated over, a lot of stuff is shorthanded, stuff's referenced to that you don't really see. And that's fine as far as it goes, but what it also means is that it really does rely on the performances to fill in the cracks. And Blunt, if you like Blunt, you'll think she's very good in this. I'm not the biggest fan of hers. I'm a bit mixed on her. I think she did well. Duplass, he's funny, but he doesn't really have the charm that the role requires, because it becomes immediately obvious as soon as Blunt turns up there out of the blue. You've got to think, okay, well, why is she there out of the blue if she said she's not going to be there for a week? So you kind of get that. You also immediately think, okay, well, why is he trying to sleep with her sister if he's just met her out of the blue, and blah blah blah. So you kind of get that. And
do you think that the director, whoever it is
Lynn Shelton, she's new,
is she saying to Emily Blunt, you're here, why you're here? Make up
I think
excuse.
So. Yeah.
Is that?
Yeah, no, I think it would be more in terms of they'll know why they're there. They'll know the character's backstory. They'll have worked that out, and then they'll just shove them in maybe in rehearsals. If it's like Mike Lee, then I'd guess what they do is they do the rehearsals and then they script it. It might not be like that. It might be more, we'll just see how this goes. But obviously, that's a much more expensive way to work, because you've got to shoot actually a load more film. So the problem with this is it's relentlessly predictable,
right?
From scene to scene to scene to scene to scene. You know, even when she introduced herself as a lesbian and she's just having getting to know you drinks with Duplass, you know they're gonna go end up in bed together, and point by point by point by point, it's obvious what is going to happen. But Rosemary DeWitt, unsurprisingly, she's really good.
She's great.
Yeah, she stole Rachel getting married. She's stolen this. She just gets emotion. She's a restrained actress, but she gets the emotion across in a way that Catherine Deneuve, actresses like that do. But obviously she hasn't got Catherine Deneuve's looks. Not that she doesn't look good. She looks fine. But she hasn't got the sex bomb wowness that she had. So yeah, when you put all these three in, it just lets them go. It plays itself out exactly as you'd expect, and there's a nice shot every reel or so. There's a decent enough score. There's a nice acoustic-y guitar-y thing. It's all very indie-licious, and it's fine, but it's not really something you go, oh wow, you've got to go and see this, because it's just something to take the girlfriend to on a Sunday afternoon, or preferably get the DVD from Love Film and stay in with the girlfriend and watch it and slap it on.
So
very undemanding stuff, but it's
you enjoyed it.
It's fine. I liked it, but I didn't. It's not revelatory, but it's not bad. It's fine for what it is. Fine for what it is. Right. So another one out is Joyful Noise. Is that the title?
Yes, Joyful Noise.
Which I haven't seen and you have, so I'm gonna let you run with it.
Okay. Well. It's directed by Todd Graff, who has done teen-oriented films Camp and Band Slam with Vanessa Hudgens. So not a hugely great pedigree.
Films that you hear about but don't watch.
Yes, in whispers. But this has a good cast. It's mostly black cast. It's Kiki Palmer plays the lead, who was great in Akita and the Bee. And Queen Latifah is her mother, and they're in a choir. The leader of the choir dies in the first 5 minutes. It's played by Chris Christopherson, and his wife is Dolly Parton, and she's kind of heavily involved in the choir as well, and kind of wants to be leader.
So this film has Dolly Parton and Queen Latifah in it.
Oh yeah.
Right, my dad is definitely going to be watching this when it comes on Sky.
Yeah, this is a diva-heavy film. And so it's about the church choir and the kind of progress from the leader dying. Queen Latifah becomes the leader, but she suffers kind of conflict within the group, and mainly from Dolly Parton, and they go into a national competition. So,
of course.
Yeah, of course. As you do.
Yeah.
So, there's obvious comparisons to Sister Act 2 and stuff like that.
That's the first film you've ever said that sentence
music
about.
Music of the Heart.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
Genius.
It's true.
Genius.
Bring It On, but Bring It On's kind of more tongue in cheek. But yeah, I mean,
how are the songs?
The songs are good. The music's really good. I don't think it's original music, but except for one song, I think it's by,
which I heard on the radio last week.
Yeah, you liked it, didn't you?
Yeah, that was a good song. Yeah. For what it is, for radio too.
Yeah, well, it's got a chance at a Oscar song nomination. Although that's.
What was the last thing that Parton got nominated for? Transamerica.
Yeah, I think it was Traveling Through. It was called. Yeah. And she lost to the Pimps.
Was that 3-6 Mafia?
Yeah.
The infamous 3-6 Mafia won. Martin Scorsese 0.
That was a bad time for her.
they made up that one pretty quick.
Yeah. But. The acting is probably the best part of it, just because the actors are having fun with it. Dolly and Queen Latifah have like a food fight in the middle of it.
Well, they're natural performers, both of them.
Yeah, they light up the screen kind of thing. You know, they can kind of give it, and they get like lots of like kind of bitchy lines to say. which is great. You know, Dolly Parton's kind of got loads of really weird lines where she, because it's heavily Christian, and she's like doling out these line, like moralistic lines to them,
like Bible quoting stuff.
More like, you don't get any chow if you don't feed the chickens, that kind of thing. She's like random like
sayings,
words of wisdom, yeah. So that's kind of fun. But with this kind of film, you get lots of kind of extraneous subplots, and it's very, very sentimental, very manipulative.
Right.
There's a lot about the mother-daughter relationship between Queen Latifah and Keke Palmer, and the estranged father's involved, and he comes back, and it's all a bit too much. But there are some scenes that kind of elevated away from that. Like, there's a particularly heated argument that they have, the mother and daughter, and it's sort of like, well, you can see other films that are going for the same kind of effect as Joyful Noise wouldn't have gone as far as it has with issues.
Right.
But this one's willing to go there, which I admire. I just think at 2 hours, and it doesn't kind of stray enough from where you'd expect it to go.
Right. Yeah.
So
yes.
So what, why didn't you want to see this? Because you could have saw it, but you didn't.
Too much this week. I mean, I've been to the cinema 4 times since Friday, I think. Now
that's commendable.
So it was just too much on. One of the latest of which before tonight was at the Warwick Arts Centre for Les Bien-Aimés, which is the new musical from Christophe Honoré.
Right. What's is that? Beloved, yeah.
Yeah, but beloved, yeah.
Beloved.
I don't know if it's beloved or beloved. It could be either.
Is it as good as Oprah Winfrey's Beloved?
I've never actually seen more than 15 minutes of that one, so.
Missing out.
But, I doubt it's better than that. I haven't seen Honoré's previous musical, Love Songs, which is from about 5 or 6 years ago, but it basically has the same cast, which is essentially Chiara Mastroianni, who's obviously Marcello Mastroianni and Catherine Deneuve's daughter.
Yeah.
She in this plays a woman in the late 90s who is sort of like straddling life, love, work, etc., etc. The first 45 minutes is Ludivine Sagnier back in the 1960s playing her mother, who was an assistant at a shoe shop who turns tricks on the side to keep her in good clothes. So Sagnier meets a Czech doctor who ends up fathering Chiara Mastroianni. In the later portion, Catherine Deneuve, who's Chiara's real life mother, plays the mom, the Sagnier role, and Miloš Forman randomly plays the dad.
That really
and
is I say,
and it's equally random because in the 60s portion, the guy playing the doctor is at least a foot taller than Sagnier, and then he's pretty much the same size as Deneuve. So I don't know whether the good doctor had an encounter with some sort of contagious shrinking disease. Which, frankly, if there was a song about that, there should have been a song about that. Yes, about every 15 minutes or so, they check in a song. And the songs aren't great. They're not bad, but they're just there. And it just pads it out. It's 140 minutes long, and the songs just pad it out. And so the first 45 minutes is really obviously a Jacques Demy homage.
Yeah.
And then
Umbrellas of Cherbourg.
Umbrellas of Cherbourg, Young Girls of Rochefort. Was there a film called Lola? There's one with the one from the L-shaped room, Leslie Caron, I think. I'm not even, but yeah, I've not seen that. Umbrellas of Cherbourg, and so the films that sort of made Deneuve's name back in the day. And the problem with this is that is sort of like your kitsch value for the first 45 minutes of the film. And then when it gets into the late 90s, early 2000s section, he starts bringing in all these really big backdrops, and it comes off as pretentious, because suddenly Chiara Mastroianni, she meets Paul Schneider. Paul Schneider is in this film. How brilliant is that?
The Scott.
Yeah, the Scott from Bright Star. And he's a drummer in a band who's gay, and it's a really random plot thing. He's gay, and he takes her back to his place, and then he kind of leads her on, and he goes down on her in the toilet at the French Institute. It is really, really, really random.
Whoa.
And then over the next few years, she falls completely in love with him, and he kind of strings her along, and it's a really strange plot. But that they have the best song, where it's kind of reminded me of New York, New York, when with the dance with Liza. Did they actually put spotlights on them in the street? But even if that doesn't happen, in my memory it did. So that was the best one in terms of staging. But they bring in that randomness, and then he thinks he's got AIDS. So you got the AIDS question, which isn't really fleshed out at all.
God.
And then she goes over to meet him in America on September the 11th, and so she gets rerouted to Canada. So there's all these like these big issues as backdrops or plot points.
How long does it span?
It spans about 40, 50 years. Right. It spans from like 64, I think, to 2008, and it comes in and out. It has all these really big things, but then it doesn't detail them. So what you're doing is you're just using something as immediately barbing as AIDS, so if you're not going to explore it, you're just using it, and so that's why it's pretentious, because it's using this importance of September the 11th, and it's just exploiting it. It's not actually it doesn't provide any real boost to the drama. It's just there to jolt you and go, oh, it's AIDS, okay, that's serious. Or, oh, it's September 11th, that's really depressing.
It sounds like that Hurricane Katrina thing in Benjamin Button.
Exactly, precisely. And so I'm making this sound really bad, but what drags it up to okay is Chiara Mastroianni. She is super in this film. She's got all of her mother's restraint and all of her dad's charm. She really does nail this one, and I can't decide if it's a supporting performance or a lead performance. This is the thing I was talking to you about online the other day. I can't decide, because she's got like over an hour's worth of section where she's the main person, and she is but regardless, she's super, and she is the reason to see the film. And because you're not going to be humming any of the songs on the way out, and it's really, really long. There's no energy in this film at all. But she's really good.
Okay.
And that's what I'd say on that. So that there endeth the French Quarter.
Yeah.
Because we've got to have the French every week.
A very short French Quarter this week. It'll be longer next week, I think.
Yeah, maybe we can pipe some music in. So, on to the biggest. Was Killer Joe the biggest release last week? It's certainly the biggest pimped.
I think it's the biggest. Director.
Biggest director, probably biggest in terms of marketing as well. I didn't really see much marketing for Friends with Kids.
Well, Spider-Man.
Maybe.
Oh. Yeah, that's we're counting kind Spider-Man of this next week.
Yeah. So Killer Joe, tell me about Killer Joe. The actual. Basic plot.
Killer Joe. It's about Emil Hirsch is sort of a young delinquent in Trailer Trash Texas. He's in trouble with local drug lords, so he has the bright idea of hiring Matthew McConaughey's Killer Joe to murder his estranged alcoholic mother for life insurance. It's $50,000.
Yes.
But once Joe learns that they can't pay until he's killed her, then he kind of takes on Emil Hirsch's sister Dottie, played by Juno Temple, as sort of kind of insurance, because he's attracted to her, and sort of chaos ensues.
Mm. Right.
Where would you start with this?
I would start with this by going back about 5 years.
Right.
And that's because I came out of this film, and at the very beginning of the film, it says, based on the play by Tracy Letts, and that meant nothing to me. Absolutely nothing to me. And when I came out of the film, I just thought, this was just like Bug, in that it amps itself up for about an hour or a bit more, and then I thought falls apart in the third act, because it just goes way too far, it's way too crazy, it's just out there. And I got back, went on IMDb, and lo and behold, Bug was based on a play by Tracy Letts and written by Tracy Letts as well, which is exactly the same as this.
Yeah.
So I'm giving this even less of a short leash because he's already been there and done it.
But still, people aren't adapting plays these days as interesting as Tracy Letts' plays seem to be.
Oh yeah.
So.
Yeah. I think this would be the problem. I think it's just that they are interesting up to a point, and then I don't think where he takes those in the last. It's like Danny Boyle syndrome. It's like it's like Sunshine. 2/3 of the way through, and then it just falls off the cliff. Or that's what Kermode just said about Sofia Coppola. She was 2/3 of a good filmmaker.
That's just wrong.
But. So I disagree with that one on Coppola as well. Yeah. So with this one, I think there's just is it a comedy?
Yes.
Because I think it's supposed to be a comedy, and I think that Friedkin just sucked all the potential comedy out of it. So the only times I was laughing was Thomas Hayden Church as the idiot dad.
Yeah.
He has about 4 laugh out loud moments. I mean, you can see how it's a comedy, because Emil Hirsch says, "Yeah, let's off mom," and nobody, like, even bats an idea. Oh, okay, fine.
Yeah, but most of the laughs are kind of nervous laughs.
Schadenfreude. Yeah.
There's especially a scene towards the end which
we'll get on to.
Yeah, but generally there's a sort of side of black comedy that runs through it, mainly through probably Matthew McConaughey's just his general tone, this sort of self-indulgent, kind of non-serious, kind of badass. It's good to see him like this again. I liked him in The Lincoln Lawyer. Yeah. I like him here.
I liked him in Tropic Thunder. I thought that was a really nice change of pace. So he's doing better, more interesting stuff than he used to.
Yeah.
There are just the little things that just bother me, both in terms of, like, intellectually as I was watching it, and then sort of like morally as I'm watching it.
It's reprehensible morally the whole way through.
It's one of my pet peeves, and I don't want to harp on it too much, but there is way more female nudity in this film than there is male. There's like one scene of like McConaughey's ass for about 2 seconds, and then the women just get everything off whenever they can. But then intellectually, there's stuff like, okay, the point of the plot is that you've said Hirsch owes some dodgy people some money, and he goes and asks he needs $6,000. He goes and asks for his dad at the beginning of the film for $1,000 because he can hold them off with $1,000, but his dad doesn't have it. And so then they're divvying up the money, and then if they get the life insurance, then that will cover his $6,000. He then has the money to go and do other random stuff. He has the money to go and place a bet. He has some money for something else as well. You've got the money to put a load of money on a bet and buy a gun, which is just going to put you even in more you're not going to put any of you said at the beginning you can get them off with a grand. Why not do that and just buy yourself some time? So it doesn't make sense.
Well, you don't know
sense
how much it can cost in those areas. It might $50.
You think it'd be a few hundred, I would have thought, for a gun. Well,
I think there's a lot of problems with kind of coming across as convincing.
And also,
this kind of area.
Do you use a word like misogynistic for this film? For the basic plot is basically them pimping out the daughter / sister as collateral. I mean, is it misogynistic or is it a film about misogynists?
I think it's a film about misogynists.
It's a delicate line, and they don't, and Priekin doesn't deal with it delicately.
I think the fact that it's a comedy, pretty much.
Well, supposed to be a comedy.
It is a comedy.
He does it so seriously, though. There is one scene that is a comedy because
it's not funny. It's kind of nervously
chicken,
funny.
The chicken leg
the
scene.
Fried chicken, yeah.
Yes. There were war cats in this film.
Yeah, were there? I was surprised there weren't any with me.
There were war cats in this film, and I think you've got to know. I mean, the trailer was really trashy. I mean, it looks like a trashy film, and it is a trashy film. There's just no getting around it. I think regardless of what you think of the where they take it in the final third, and personally, I think it wets the bed, but that's just me. There's enough acting on show. I think up until that point, I thought it was a very decent film. Afterwards, it depends how much you dislike that, or if you don't dislike it, it doesn't matter at all. But I think anyway, even if you do, there's enough acting here to hold your interest. Personally, for me, standout was Juno Temple.
Yes, definitely.
I thought she was really good.
She always is, but like particularly great.
She's got a lot to do in this. She's got a lot to do in this.
She's the kind of trophy for everybody, really. She's the key to everything.
And she's pulled around, but then again, she's got to play a very innocent girl, but she's also got to play. But then again, she's innocent, but then she doesn't have any problem with them offing the mother.
Yeah, and she's got no moral conscience, really.
No, so she's the in the middle between, essentially in a power play between Emile Hirsch and Matthew McConaughey. And so she holds it all together. I think if you didn't have as good an actress as her, it would be a much worse film. I think if you had somebody who wasn't, I didn't think McConaughey was amazing, but I thought he was really solid. And again, if you didn't have him anchoring it, I hate to think what this film would be. But I just think, for me, the tone from Friedkin is so done so seriously. But what I like is it's beautifully shot. It's by Zoe's dad, Caleb Deschanel.
Yeah.
Really, really nicely shot, and the sound design's awful. So it's just one of those really random mixed. It's like just like it's just like some of the others we've been talking about this week. It is a mixed bag, and I think Hirsch was really bad. Personally.
I knew you wouldn't like him because it's this syndrome of kind of babyface actors turning kind of sleazy, kind of slime balls.
I just wanted to punch him the whole way through, and not in a character way.
I thought he was fine because it's the most kind of upfront character of everybody, really. He's a mess, so I thought he was okay.
So is the
probably
film.
Wasn't.
So is the film for me.
I think it knows what
it's messy.
What it is,
I don't think it's
essentially. I think Friedkin's in a lot of control of it. Probably more control than he usually is.
So what did you think of Bug?
I liked Bug. I think this is on the level of Bug.
This thing, I thought, for me, Bug was good up until the end, and then the end dragged it down to okay. This was decent, and then the end drags it down to, I've got to say, probably below average for me. But just because of like just certain things in there. I mean, and there are things in there that are very off-putting, and they really do try or test the audience.
I just think it does enough, like.
It has stuff on offer, definitely. But I don't think there's anything in this film as good as, say, Ashley Judd's performance in Bug. And
I thought it was intensely watchable. I didn't look at my watch once.
No, I didn't either.
And it's 100 minutes, 102 minutes, something like that.
Yeah, it does shift. I mean, and I did look at my watch tonight in Spider-Man. I did look at my watch a lot in Beloved.
Yeah.
So
just go quicker.
Yeah. Are you seriously taking this long to do this? Yeah, so overall, you quite liked it, I guess?
I really liked it, yeah.
Oh, you really liked it? Okay. Right. Cool.
Okay.
So, on which note, it's probably a good time to go into the stuff that we really liked in from the year as a whole.
Yeah, because we don't kind of praise things enough, I feel.
No.
So, I was thinking just I'll do like 5 and then you do 5-4 and then I'll do 4-3 kind of thing.
Oh, so we'll run through the top 5 and then do acting?
Yeah.
Okay. Right? Yeah. Go for it.
Okay, number 5. May surprise you.
Okay.
Last week's the 5-year engagement.
Right.
I think that it's very well conceived. I think that Apatow is producing films that kind of Mike Nichols and James L. Brooks were producing in the 80s, or directing rather, mm-hmm. kind of adult films that kind of knew the limitations, and I think that it...
Yeah, different tone, but similar type of aspirations.
Yeah, and I think that it's very well acted, and I really enjoyed it. And I also don't think that has been a lot of great films. It's a B film for me, but it's solid.
This is the point. So my number 5 is going to offend you.
Really?
And it's a 7 out of 10, which is like a low B. It's a 4-star film, just for me. But it's like a low B in Cal's kind of ratings. This was a toss up between two, but it's Dark Shadows. Which I know you didn't like. Dark Shadows is actually in my top 5.
A low B?
Oh, it's a 7 out of 10 for me, yeah.
Alright, okay. Yeah. Yeah, I hated it.
Yeah, I know, that's why I said it's going to offend you. Yeah, because while it does have its flaws, I found it really entertaining consistently throughout the film.
Right.
That's enough to get in the top 5 at this point in the year.
Do you think that's about the time period then, or?
Yeah, I think it has something to do with it, and also I didn't find the tone as off as other people who didn't like the film did.
Oh.
So I mean, if I can just put this into a bit of perspective, this was fighting it out for the final spot with salmon fishing in the Yemen, which I liked, but unspectacular.
Right.
So, Right, so your number 4?
Well, you do your number 4. No.
Okay, my number 4 is Prometheus.
Ooh, okay.
Yeah, which again, I mean, I think if I hadn't seen Alien, this would probably be a bit higher.
Yeah.
But because I have seen Alien.
I agree. It would be higher for me.
So I think it does what it says on the tin. I think it's does some certain aspects of it very well, and it's very well made. And it's just a shame I've seen it before.
Yeah, done better.
Yes.
Okay, my number 4 is Killer Joe.
Ah.
Which
recent.
Yeah, I don't want to rake over what we did 10 minutes ago, but.
Yeah.
I just think it was really intensely watchable for a hugely talented cast, kind of blackly comic, really sort of something you don't see very often, which is something you look for when you're having to watch Spider-Man again, like 5 years later. You kind of... It's nice to see something different,
like Gina Gershon's fellatio skills.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
you're number 3.
Better than filleting something else.
Yes, better than actually. Yeah, so number 3 then.
Mirror.
Ah, yeah, that's just around, yeah, it's up there for me as well.
I loved Mirror Mirror. I think Tarsem's just criminally undervalued. It's like, this is just such a breath of fresh air. It's just a great fairy tale film.
Mm-hmm. And it's funny.
Funny.
It's entertaining.
Yep.
And it's got Armie Hammer.
Yes. Mm. It's got Armie Hammer.
And now back to the offence, because you're not going to like this. My number three of the year is Lay the Favourite, because again, I found it pretty entertaining all the way through, and it's pretty without Rebecca Hall, this would not be anywhere really on the radar, but considering she's in it, I enjoyed it quite a lot, so that's why it's there.
Yeah, I think it's definitely very watchable, as I said last week.
Mm.
I just didn't really kind of think it went as far as it could have gone.
Mm.
But
that's fair.
Fine.
Mm, that's fair enough. My number two and my number one are sort of half cheating, but my number two is Pirates and Adventures in an Adventure with Scientists. So it's an animated film, which is not really cheating, but yeah, this was the most fun I've had in the cinema this year, and I like the little side jokes they sort of go throughout, like the sort of characters wearing blue Peter hats and what have you, and some very random cameos like Salma Hayek and Lenny Henry and Brian Blessed as the Pirate King. I think it's a very British film, but it's got its tongue firmly in its cheek, and I enjoyed it a lot.
I usually like Aardman stuff, but I like Queen Victoria as a villain as well.
Yes,
that's good.
Yeah,
but I just didn't feel it this time.
Mm-hmm. So you number two?
Number two is Cabin in the Woods.
Ooh.
Which I loved.
Which I didn't see.
Yeah, you should have seen it.
Apparently,
you should definitely see it now. It's very contemptuous of the audience, the way it goes, because it starts off as a kind of mini satire of a teens going to this cabin, and then it shifts into something completely different and leaves you feeling confused. Well, it would leave you feeling confused if you weren't kind of adept at the whole horror
right
kind of genre and how it works.
Yeah,
but it's like produced by Joss Whedon, obviously he's kind of into that whole thing, but I think it's really clever, even though it completely doesn't try to satisfy the audience, which is a bit like, it almost feels resentful of its audience, like, come and see this, and you know,
we don't care if you like it or if you follow it or
yeah, exactly. So yeah, but I thought it was great. So
right, and the number two.
Number one, Damsels in Distress.
I thought so.
Directed by Whit Stillman, and just a really funny comedy about a group of girls who are at college in America, and they just wreak havoc. But they don't wreak havoc in the usual way. They kind of run the suicide clinic, and they kind of give people donuts, and they listen to classical music, create new dance crazes, and it's just a barrel of laughs. It's really great, quirky. So what's your number one?
My number one, which is out of left field, but we have talked about it on the podcast, and it's The Last Projectionist, which is purely because I really undersold last week just how much of a experience it is. When you've got a personal attachment to a particular cinema, and then there's a documentary made about it, and then you watch it in there, it's purely for the trimmings that actually have less to do with the film itself. But the film itself still is entertaining. It's informative. There is stuff that you wouldn't really have thought about, and it rattles along. It's only 80 minutes, which is always nice. And,
yeah.
Yes, I'm gonna pimp the going to pimp the Brummy documentary in my position as West Midlands cultural and Amy Adams affairs correspondent for this podcast.
Amy Adams yet to grace the podcast.
Yeah, well, I had to get her in somehow. It's been 5 weeks.
Well, I think we're going to have to wait till November. The Master in November.
I'm sure. I can't believe I mentioned the Muppets last week and didn't mention her. I must have been having a stroke or something. I mean, okay.
It's just been too long. It's been too long.
Yes, yeah. By stroke, I meant the. I did mean as in the neurological attack, as opposed to any other potential
stroke
diversions.
Moving on.
Yeah, shall we go supportings then? So direction. So my director win is Frears, because I think considering I like the film, I like the tone, rattled along, and I thought it was well made. Your director win would be then, I'm not guessing the guy from Damsels in Distress. I'd guess it'd be something else, or would I be wrong?
It's probably the Cabin in the Woods guy, Drew Goddard. Because it's more arterial.
My supporting actress lineup's a bit of a challenge, but I'm going to go.
It's a huge challenge for me.
Oh, no, no. I mean, a challenge to narrow it down, because there's a lot that I like.
Really?
Yes. Because I've got Judy and Susan Sarandon in Jeffrey Lives at Home. We're very close to it, but I went for Kristen Scott Thomas in Salmon Fishing in the Yemen. She basically plays Alistair Campbell in The Dress. She's hilarious. She's just
bitchy.
She's the press secretary for the. She's just bossing everyone about, just lording it over everyone. She's really funny. Okay. It's a really good performance.
I went for Juno Temple in Killerjaw.
I pushed a lead.
Yeah, I debated, but then I thought Emil Hirsch and Matthew McConaughey were more lead, and it was about what they were kind of. She was on the sidelines, and them considering her more.
Yeah, I would. She would win if I had a supporting. I think she's better than Thomas, Scott Thomas.
Right.
So your supporting actor.
Armie Hammer in Mirror Mirror.
Who is my runner-up?
Oh, really? Didn't make it. Well. Yeah. I just think he's hilarious and just really fun, like James Marsden in Enchanted, but better.
Mm. He's got some out there stuff to do, like with the puppy love.
Yeah,
it's a fully committed performance. You can't go for that by halves. It was for me an absolute toss up, and I went for the Sheikh in Salmon Fishing in the Yemen, Amir Wakid. I'm no idea how you pronounce that, but it really is. He was just very nice, had a very nice presence, and because he's supposed to be playing this crazy guy, but he's actually quite normal, and so it was a nice, I think it was a good approach to take. And it's one of those, do you remember when The Woodsman came out and you had all these people praising Mos Def because he had this one, he had the role of the cop who's got to keep an eye on Kevin Bacon's paedophile. And most guys would do it just really brutal in your face, but the way that he did it, he was very subtle, and he was like, it was even more menacing because he was being so because of the approach that he took as an actor. It's not the usual choice, so I think that's kind of the only reason why I went for him over Hammer. Just he was just doing things that you wouldn't normally expect from that role.
Okay.
Right, my actress, I've already mentioned her, Hall in Lay the Favourite, but it's close. I've got the likes of Temple in Killerjoe and Eva Green in Dark Shadows around there, and Lots in The Pact and DeWitt in Your Sister, and Binoche in Elle. I thought she was good. So there's lots of people for me, but I think Hall was probably a distance above the rest for me, because she is that film, and if you like that film, then she's the reason why you'll like it.
Yeah, I'd agree with that. I think she's like kind of sixth or that kind of thing for me.
Yeah,
I don't mean to bleat on about this, but I have Jennifer Lawrence in The Hunger Games as number one.
I thought you were going to say Greta.
No. I think she's like three, something
right.
like that.
Okay.
But anyway. But yeah, I've said this last week. I think I did it, was it last week?
Yeah, last week, yeah.
but I just think she anchors the film tremendously, and I think she gives it, I think she ups a grade the film,
right,
almost.
That, and that's the sign of a good actress. That's my Amy Adams. I would say I would have mentioned Amy anyway. That's my Amy Adams thing. Amy Adams raises this quality of a film by a star just by being in it. She certainly does that in Junebug, and certainly does it in The Muppets. Certainly does it in Enchanted. Can you imagine Enchanted without Amy Adams?
Yeah, exactly. She makes Enchanted, definitely.
So your
my actor is, want to hazard a guess?
I'm going to guess McConaughey.
No.
Have I forgotten something that you liked?
It's Mr. Pattinson.
Oh, of course, yeah. I did forget something you like. Amazingly, he wasn't in my top 10 as I was just looking, scrolling down for ideas.
Mr. Pattinson in Cosmopolis. This has already been reiterated. I just thought he was really good, really mixed up a lot of different sides to the character. He was very businessy, and in the scenes with his girlfriend, he was really kind of brought the child in the character.
Mm-hmm.
Just really thought he was tip top.
Cool.
So what's yours?
Mine is, it's the only guy, because what I do is when I sort of like rank people, I sort of split them into basic, very generic categories, like good, very good, excellent, that sort of thing. And the one guy that's in a category all on his own is Mikael Falsgaard from A Royal Affair, who played the Mad King.
Oh yeah,
in A Royal Affair. Mentioned him a few weeks ago, and it's one of those roles where it's very easy to go wrong, and he gets better and better the longer it goes. And it's an impressive performance, because it's a big performance. But it's a big performance that he doesn't get tempted by the going more big than he really should, and by the end he really fleshes out the character's quandaries in a way which wouldn't necessarily be there on the page. So yeah,
we have a blog. moveforpodcast.blogspot.com. We have a Twitter at moveforpodcast.
We're on iTunes.
We are on iTunes.
We're sometimes on our blogs as well for this podcast. And I'm just going to flick up some potential teasers for what we are going to be talking about next week.
Well, we're talking about the BAFTA Oscar rule changes.
Yes, that's
a recently announced
discussion point. We might finally get round to talking about The Fairy, which is a film that's been doing the round, and maybe Le Havre as well, because they're coming out. Well, they're out already, but they're going to be around cinemas where I am. And yeah. Considering that I got chills 4 times watching the Chariots of Fire trailer, because it's being re-released, and we'll probably be talking about that as well, because it is coming out again for the Olympics. So that's what we got next week.
So we're not doing Katy Perry, Part of Me.
Amazingly, that one's going to pass me by.
Wow.
And I sound almost as sure about that as when I originally said that Magic Mike was going to pass me by, but I might have somehow.
I think you may have been hasty there.
I think I've tacitly agreed that I've tacitly told you I'm going to watch it, because I agreed for it to be the ending section, and the ending section is always something that we both talk about. So I want to be Bruce Willis in 12 Monkeys. I just want to stop that virus from spreading, because because I think the trailer's so bad.
It's the C-tier effect.
The trailer is so bad. Anyway. Right.
You can get through it.
Yeah, well, yes. Well, this is the thing. I'm secure enough in my masculinity to go and watch a film about male strippers. I just am. That's how I roll.
Mon man.